Hello and welcome to Bowel Cancer UK's podcast. Now, we're the UK's leading bowel cancer charity. We're determined to save lives and improve the quality of life of everyone affected by bowel cancer. We fund targeted research. We provide expert information and support to patients and their families. We educate the public and professionals about the disease and campaign for early diagnosis and access to the best treatment and care. Hello, I'm George Alagaya. You probably know me best as a man who presents the news quite a few evenings a week on the BBC's News at 6. But I'm also someone who's living with cancer. I was diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer back in 2014, I should say. Now, today we're going to talk about young people and bowel cancer, and we'll talk about just what constitutes a young person in a minute. Here in the studio with me, we have Sarah Bates, who was diagnosed with stage 3 bowel cancer at 39 years old. We also have an old friend of ours, Professor Mark Saunders here, consultant clinical oncologist at the Christie NHS Foundation Trust in Manchester, where they, I know, do some brilliant things. Thank you both for being with me here. Sarah, let's start with you. 39 years old. It's not an age at which you're sort of thinking about cancer.
No, not at all. It's quite a shock.
What was it like? Do you mind talking about it?
No. So I was pregnant with my third child, and I noticed a bit of blood when I went to the loo. Throughout the pregnancy, it was happening a little bit, but not all the time. I wasn't massively worried. So my son was born and everything was fine. But I continued to bleed a little bit when I went to the loo. And I just thought, this can't be put down to pregnancy.
No.
It's not piles. I'll go to the doctors and get checked out.
Because, I mean, just to wind back, I mean, before, while you were pregnant, it was plausible, presumably, that
yes,
you could have a bit of bleeding.
Totally. You know? Yeah. And so many unusual things happen to your body when you're pregnant that, you know, you can put things down to just being pregnant. But I went to the doctors and I just explained that I was having a little bit of intermittent bleeding when I went to the loo. I said, look, I'm not massively worried about it, but it's been going on for some time.
How long after your pregnancy was it going?
So my son was about 4 months old.
Oh, so is it quite a long time,
yes,
really,
yes,
to have carried on having this bleeding?
Yeah. Yes. So she was lovely, the GP. I remember being really embarrassed and sort of saying, I'm really sorry that you're going to have to look at my bottom. And and she was just so nice. You know, she really put me at my ease. And she referred me straight on to a colorectal surgeon, which I was really fortunate to see him, because I think a lot of people don't always get passed on so quickly, or referred on so quickly, I should say.
She referred you on to a colorectal surgeon because she found something?
Well, she did an examination and she just said, I can tell that you're bleeding and I'm not quite sure what's going on. But I think she saw some blood on the examination. And so I saw the colorectal surgeon and he did a colonoscopy and he removed 3 polyps. And he sort of said, look, now we've seen these, we will monitor you. And I felt reassured, you know, and I knew that I'd be going back to see him at various points and that I would be monitored. But as time went on, the bleeding actually continued. Again, it wasn't happening all the time. And I think that makes it really difficult, because if something's happening every day, you kind of think, right,
yeah,
okay, there's a problem here. But it was intermittent and it was carrying on. And I just thought, no, I'm going to see if I can go back to see him. And I did. And I went back to see him, I think it was the 23rd of December or 22nd of December.
Oh, my God, just before Christmas.
Just before Christmas. And because I'd seen him before, I really thought it was just going to be the polyps again. But he did another colonoscopy and he found a tiny tumour that was bleeding a lot. And I was, you know, sort of quite sedated. But I was still aware of what was going on and I could see the screen. And he said, you know, we found what we think is a tumour. And that was just, I wasn't expecting him to say that. It was just before Christmas. Mm. It was really,
yeah, I'm sure,
it was really hard, really hard.
Gosh. So let's take a pause there, and thank you for sharing that with us, because it's not easy, no. Is it, to look back. Mark, we need to just get some definitions out of the way. Sarah was 39. We're talking about young people. You know, what is the definition of a young person as far as bowel cancer is concerned?
I think we define it as somebody who's under 50. I know, obviously, there are many people more than 50 that get bowel cancer, but we particularly define it as under 50.
Okay.
And in fact, if you think in the UK, there's about 40,000 people get bowel cancer a year, so it's a very common cancer. Not so many get it under 50, but the figure is still about 2,500. So it's still a huge number of people get bowel cancer under the age of 50. So that's the definition, and it's a big group of people.
I mean, and if 50 is the sort of, you know, the cutoff point, if you like. I mean, Sarah was, you know, 11 years younger than
certainly,
that.
Certainly, yes, yes.
So quite unusual.
Yeah. That's it. It is unusual. And I think that's why the charity Bowel Cancer UK have had this plan to actually try and stop people under 50 dying from bowel cancer and improve clinical practice. And this is their sort of Never Too Young programme.
Well, I should say, yeah. I mean, we're here talking, but Bowel Cancer UK produced this new report, Never Too Young report. Actually, since you mentioned it, do you want to pick out a couple of the highlights of this report?
Yeah, they've been great, the charity, because actually they first actually published it in 2015, so it was a long time ago. And they've been really plugging away at this really important area for a long time, and a new report's just come out. And I think, as I said, the things that they want to do is actually try and improve clinical practice and try to stop people with bowel cancer under the age of 50 dying from it. And one of the things that does seem to come out, and it's a bit different to your journey perhaps, is that a lot of people went to the GP multiple times. And it must be very hard for a GP, and I think I'd hate to be a GP when somebody walks in with a little bleeding, because if you have a whole group of 40-year-olds walk in, they can't all have bowel cancer. Sure. In fact, very few. When you think 2,500 in a country with 60 million people, that's very unusual. And if you think of the average GP, they may go through their whole life with only ever diagnosing one under the age of...
Well, let me just... I mean, sorry to interrupt, Mark, but in the report, 4 out of 10 of the respondents in the Never Too Young report produced by Bowel Cancer UK saw their GP 3 or more times about their symptoms. I mean, that's very, very... I mean, you know, Sarah went in once and the GP straight away referred her.
I think that's right. And I think when you actually look deeper into the report and it talks about what symptoms are the most common symptoms, it's bleeding and a change in bowel habit. Now, those things... Whatever age you are, whether you're 39 or 49 or 59, if you go into a GP with bleeding and a change in bowel habit, it doesn't always mean you've got bowel cancer, but certainly that must be on the list there. Mm-hmm. And I think I would hope that GPs, there are many good GPs, would listen to that. And it is frustrating to actually read that so many went back. And it may be that patients... were frightened to go in the first place, because sometimes it's quite a delay to go there. It may be they were embarrassed about their bowels.
Well, I mean, Sarah herself, I mean, you said, you know, it was all a bit embarrassing, and
it really was. And, you know, even still, my toes kind of curl just sort of speaking about it.
Yeah.
But I don't know why, culturally, we're embarrassed, aren't we? About
and it
about
does, as much. It sometimes means that we don't go in time, and then it makes everybody's job a bit more difficult. I mean, people like Mark to treat because, you know, that delay can mean the cancer sort of
absolutely
progress. Yeah. I mean, we've got to be really careful here, Mark, haven't we?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to
start
bashing GPs,
exactly.
But I'm going to give you another stat from the report. Some respondents, you know, had asked their GP specifically whether their symptoms could be bowel cancer. And of those, 4 in 10 of the patients were told incorrectly that they were too young to have bowel cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, what is this? I mean, as I say, we're not trying to bash GPs, but is there a job of education to be done, do you think?
I think so. I think they're going on probably what is... You're likely not to have bowel cancer, maybe a better term they could have used, because you are very likely not to have bowel cancer. But I think if somebody goes back first time and then goes a second time, and each time it is they've got bleeding, they need to clearly state their symptoms, I think, rather than be embarrassed about it. If you've got bleeding, tell them. If you're finding you're leaking or you're having to rush out at night, you've got to tell the GP. Give them every bit of symptom so they can use it. And I think also the other important thing is family history as well. If you go to a GP and said, my mother had bowel cancer at the age of 48, or my brother had bowel cancer at the age of 52, then really that would make me think, is there something here really with that? So I think what patients can do, and it is definitely express your symptoms as clearly as you can. Always go back and think about your family history yourself, and because you might be slightly at risk, and that might prompt the GP to actually act much quicker.
Right. Sarah, I'm interested in how you coped, because let's make the comparison. So you were 39, I was 58, so 20 years difference. So by the time I get diagnosed, you know, my kids are left home, and I'm kind of, you know, my wife and I, Frances and I, just thinking about me, if you like. Mm-hmm. But I mean, 39 to be told you've just had a baby, you've got two other kids. I mean, what was that like?
It was really hard. So my children were 10, 8 and 1 when I was diagnosed. And I don't know, in some ways, because I'd got the children, I had an extra reason to keep fighting, if you like.
Yeah.
We were so fortunate with the amount of support that we received, and people sort of offering to take the children to school. But I really wanted to be able, when I could, to take them and to try and keep things as normal as possible, almost.
How did you share it with the children? Did you share it with children? I mean, look, again, in my case, they were in their 20s and possibly in their late 20s, mid to late 20s, so we could have an adult conversation. Did you share it with your children?
We did.
When you say we, you and your partner, husband.
Yeah, so when
what's his name?
It's Dan.
Dan. Okay. So, how did you do that?
So when the tumour was detected, Dan came to hospital with me, and he was there for that news. And we didn't say anything to the children, obviously, that night. We just thought it was best to be really honest and upfront about everything. We didn't want them sort of hearing things from, you know, close friends or from my parents. We wanted them to be aware of what was going on and to not really sort of keep secrets from them. But we decided that we would speak to them about it in a very positive way. So we explained that a tumour had been found, and yes, Mummy did have cancer.
Did you use the word tumour?
Yes, I did. And
didn't I'm assuming they said, what's a tumour, Mummy?
Yes, I think it went over their head a bit, but they knew the word cancer, you know.
Oh, did they?
And yes.
Did they?
Did.
Eight and ten, and they knew.
Yes, and they were very fearful of it, because I think, you know.
Where did that come from?
So I think they, you know, relatives have had cancer, and I think they, in their minds, they just think, gosh, cancer, it means you're going to die. And we tried really hard to be very positive about it, you know, and I'm a Christian, I've got a faith, and I said to them, you know, I'm going to come through this, it's going to be okay, God's got us. And then it was kind of sort of, we'd made this big announcement, and then it was like, right, what's for dinner? What's what am I going to watch on TV? Mm. And yet we just wanted to keep things normal, because I think had we kind of kept it a secret, they would have latched on to the fact that, that we were hiding something or something was amiss. So it just made it easier, I think, to be open.
And so what was your treatment?
So I, just after the diagnosis, I went into hospital and had a left hemicolectomy.
Gosh, what's that?
So that is when a large part of the bowel was removed. I thought I was going to be in and out in a day, you know, but that it was a week in hospital. It was quite painful. It's quite a big procedure, actually. I don't think I'd really realised. And then...
Did you have a bag?
No,
didn't have a bag. So they joined the two bits.
Possibly could happen, but I didn't have a bag, and recovered well. And then obviously the tumour was removed with the section of bowel that was taken away. And that was then tested along with some of the lymph nodes that were taken out. So I think 11 lymph nodes were removed and one tested positive for cancer, which meant that I then went on to a course of chemo. And in some ways, I felt relieved that I was going to be having the chemo because my oncologist said it was a belts and braces approach, you know, that they'd removed the tumour, the cancer had gone. But because the cancer had shown up in a lymph node, it meant that that chemo would just be belts and braces to make sure it had gone.
And to get back with the kids, I mean, so you go into, you know, in hospital for a week, as you say, you'd have had to tell them anyway at some,
yes,
you know,
yes,
because they could see this. And what was being a mum like on chemo? Because I don't know what chemo drugs you were on, but I mean, I got pretty tired very quickly.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, I was on the intravenous chemo every 3 weeks, and then I was taking oral tablets at home. It was really hard. I suffered a lot of sickness and very low energy. And I just decided to just try and take each day as it came. You know, sometimes it would just be taking the children to school and sort of sitting with Theo, my little boy, and that was it. And just sort of breaking the day into bite-sized chunks, yeah, and just trying to get through it. It was tough, but having said that, if I hadn't had a one-year-old, I probably would have come home after dropping the girls at school and gone straight back to bed and spent, yeah, the day watching telly, which, you know, obviously there's nothing wrong with that. But he was kind of my reason to be sort of having a very slow walk along the road or looking for a cat or looking at somebody's recycling bin or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Mark, so, I mean, clearly very tough.
Yes.
For Sarah. From your point of view as a doctor, as an oncologist, seeing a fit young woman, does that think, oh, I, from your point of view, oh, I can be a bit more aggressive with my treatment? I mean, do you treat younger people differently to older people?
I think the younger people are different. We try and treat everybody on what's called performance status. So if you're 70 and you've lived a fit and healthy life, then we would give you the same chemotherapy as somebody who's 40. If you're 40 or say maybe 50 or 60 and you smoke and drunk and you're overweight and you've got heart problems, then we can't always give the best chemotherapy. So, but in general, if you've got a fit young person, you usually can tolerate every best drug we can give. Whereas if you're in your late 70s, 80s, it's sometimes harder to give those treatments, even though, right, we try not to be ageist in that way.
Right.
But I think it's when I get a referral letter, and I suppose one of the first things you do is look for the date of birth and how old is that person. And you can't help, you remember all patients for different reasons, but you can't help but remember the younger people much more, perhaps, than the older people, because I'm 57, so I'm old now, I suppose, because I'm not in that classification as under 50.
Yeah.
But it's when people are younger than me and you see them come along with their children, and or they come with their parents as well. So usually if you're elderly, you just come with your children, but you've got both people to think about.
Right.
You've also got financial things, because usually people in their 50s are working. And so suddenly they've never thought about not working. And then you find out you've only got 6 weeks full pay, and then you're down to nothing or half pay, and it's very difficult financially as well. So there are a lot of things that are actually slightly different, and I think younger people possibly need more support because of all the extra bits.
You're right, I hadn't thought about that actually, because as I said, I was 58, I pretty much sorted out my mortgage, you know. So and as I say, our boys had left home and so on, so in, yeah, a way, yeah, we had fewer things to worry about than Sarah. And were you conscious, Sarah, of just kind of being cheerful even when you didn't feel like it, just so the kids didn't pick up?
Yeah,
the
do
vibes?
You know what I was? And I had this wonderful talk with one of the chemo nurses, and she said to me just before I started my treatment, she said, "Life on chemo is still life." And that really stuck with me, actually, because I just thought, yeah, you know, we've got to try and keep things normal and we've got to try and do some nice things.
Yeah.
And I am still me, you know. So we would still go out for the odd bite to eat, and I would go to parents' evenings. You know, I had to be careful with infection.
Yeah.
But I was able to know at what points in the chemo cycle I would be feeling okay. Mm. So yeah, we did try and keep things really, really positive. And I actually had a little journal where I would write things down that had happened that were really good, because, you know, this journey has been horrendous. It's been awful, but I have met some really lovely people along the way, and had some wonderful chats with people in hospital, other cancer patients or medical staff. And people have just been amazing, you know, friends and neighbours.
Isn't that interesting? You know, I think I might have said this before in one of these podcasts, but it's worth repeating because, you know, obviously I wish I'd never had cancer, but I'm not sure that I'd give the last 6 years back.
Sure, yeah.
Actually, my life is in so many ways richer for the things that I've been through. Mark, let's look at some of the facts. You know, so is there evidence to suggest that more young people are getting bowel cancer than they used to?
Definitely the incidence of bowel cancer in the young is increasing. I think you might then ask why.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's hard to answer that. And I don't know if there is a definite answer. I think in my own mind, it may well be the change in sort of the Western diet and lifestyle. If you look over the last 20 years, we may be eating the wrong foods. We may be not exercising as much. Obesity is increasing. It could be a change in even bacteria, for example, inside of the bowel. And I know that Bowel Cancer UK have a research project for the young looking at different bacteria in the bowel. So there could be a number of reasons why it's increasing. But whatever it is increasing.
Because actually, I'm just looking at my notes here.
Yeah.
And I got these figures from Bowel Cancer UK. Mm. There's been a 45% rise in the number of under 50s diagnosed with the disease since 2004. That's what, 16? Yeah. I mean, that's not long. Isn't it? That's a massive increase.
It is. But to answer exactly why it's increased, that's hard to say. Obviously, there's genetics come into it as well. We do know a lot about genes nowadays. And there's, I know we spoke with Sarah outside about checking for Lynch syndrome, for example.
Mm. Which is the one where it's handed down.
That's
hereditary.
It, exactly. And so we always now test for something called MSI high. And so we look to see, has that person got a susceptibility to bowel cancer? But the vast majority of cancers aren't genetic related. They probably are, we just don't know the genes.
As a matter of interest, yours isn't a...
No, I was tested and it's... Yeah,
okay, it sorry, positive. I interrupted.
So even though we can't find a gene, it may be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, we do find genes that are the cause of it. So it may well be in people who are younger, there's a much more genetic component, and it could be the other things related as well. And I suppose, what can you advise young people? I suppose to try and have a healthy diet, to have not be overweight, to try definitely not to smoke. That's certainly a risk factor.
Smoking and bowel cancer.
We know about
smoking and lung cancer.
And lung cancer. But it's odd. For example, even with anal cancer, which is a cancer of the right at the bottom of the bowel, the anus, there's an increased risk as well with smoking as
really?
Well.
Really?
So I think smoking, people think it just goes in the lungs and out, but it goes in your sinuses, in your nose, down in your throat, in your stomach. It gets through in the back, gets out in the bladder. So the bladder cancers increase. So in fact, when you think of smoking, it isn't just lung cancer, it can be a lot of cancers, as well as all the cardiac problems as well, the heart attacks.
I've got a little confession, actually. So I gave up smoking cigarettes years and years and years ago, but I do. I used to like a cigar of a summer evening down at the bottom of the garden. It's one of the few things I've given up alcohol, more or less.
Yeah.
Well, the few things I still miss is my cigar down at the bottom of the garden.
It can't be perfect. I mean, I'm not certainly. I eat red meat, as we were saying, about once a week. I'm certainly not thin. I exercise regularly. I try and do the best.
I wish there was a camera in. He's a picture of fitness.
Fitness. But saying that, it's you're not perfect. You just have to do your best with it all, really. I think
so. To check, I don't know whether this is kind of just layperson's mythology or science. Is cancer in a person as young as Sarah more aggressive than in a person like me?
I think there's suggestions that it could be more aggressive in younger people. It may be that we remember it more, and there may be many reasons why we remember somebody who's 39 who may get cancer and may have a lot of troubles and sadly die from it in a much younger age. It could be, and I think, again, that's another thing that a lot of researchers are looking at, and particularly Bowel Cancer UK. They are particularly looking why people get cancer when they're young, and also are they more aggressive, really? So it's possible, but it's probably not the main reason.
Okay. No. Sarah, so when I was diagnosed at 58, and cancer, as you know, I'm sure, that you know, is as much in the head as it is in the body, dealing with it, over a period of few months, you think about it and so on. And I kind of got to the place, I call it a place of contentment. And what I mean by that is I thought, you know, I'm 50, I've had a great career, I've got a lovely family, I've done lots of things. I started my journey, you know, in a small house in Colombo in Sri Lanka without a toilet, and look where I am now. So I got to this place of contentment, okay? I'm just wondering what it must have been like for you so much younger to deal with it in your head, and did you get any help?
Yeah, I did. Do you know that? I think when you're dealing with it yourself and you're going through something, you the adrenaline sort of kicks in, and I was okay. But I think the thing that really got me was the thought that I might not survive, and I might leave my kids. And
yeah.
That's the one thing that it was just heartbreaking, and I'd kind of spend a lot of time thinking about this, and I still get quite emotional thinking about it because
sure.
I just didn't want to leave them without a mum. Mm. And I remember, you know, I used to kiss them goodnight and sort of watch over them and just think, oh, I just want to be here. Mm. And I got through the chemo and it was hard, but there was that sense of adrenaline, as I said. But, do you know, I think it was afterwards that I struggled once my treatment had finished and once I'd kind of had my scan and everything was looking okay and the appointments at the hospital became less frequent. And that's when I started to really think, oh, my goodness, I think the enormity of what I'd been through started to sink in, and I really struggled, and I had counselling at that point, and it was really helpful to just take that time out to unpack it, to process it, and my husband had counselling as well.
Really?
To just try and come to terms with it, because I think, you know, we'd taken such a knock as a family and we'd coped with so much and we'd carried it, and then you come through it and you're like, oh my goodness,
yeah,
it's big.
This reminds me actually of a previous podcast we've done with someone who, like you, had kind of got through the treatment, but then found it really difficult to deal with the anxiety of thinking it might come back.
Yes, definitely.
And needed help then.
Yes, and I think the hospital appointments, you know, they're not as frequent, but I feel incredibly anxious, more so than when I was on chemo, because, you know, you're suddenly back, you're seeing familiar faces, the smell, the soap, everything, you know, it comes back to you, and it's really nerve-wracking, definitely.
How conscious are you, Mark, that, so 39, you know, a young person's got so much more to live for, or do you, you know, compared to someone like me now, you know, mid 60s, that you have to be aware of their psychology when you're as an oncologist.
Yeah, you do. I think again, I suppose if you again looked at a 70-year-old, they still got a great lot to live for.
Yes,
as well.
I sort of put it badly.
I know you meant that.
I feel I've got everything to live for, but
exactly, but, and we all have. And but I think it's really good that you did accept counselling, because I think sometimes, especially with younger people having to deal with the financial side, the children's side of it, there's lots of things. There's the sexual side of things. There's all sorts of issues that may come out more in the younger person there. And sometimes people think it's a failure. I'm not mad. I don't need to see a counsellor. But actually, it's right, because it can help both the patient and also the partner. And we did a survey at the Christie about who is the most anxious. Is it the patient or is it the partner? And actually, it was pretty clear it was the partner. And because I think sometimes you've got so much to do in those every 2 or 3 week visits, and you can concentrate on that. Your poor old partner, Dan, probably doesn't know what to do there, really.
Yeah.
And then again, when you said, we have a lot of people, when we suddenly say, oh, we don't want to see you for 3 months now, actually, they were so used to coming every 2 weeks, and maybe even before that because of blood tests. Actually, it's hard then. And then again, when you come, you probably come for scans.
Mm.
And the thought of sitting outside in a room And I was saying to Sarah outside, my wife had a minor problem, and we sat there waiting for one of the surgeons to come in, and it was all fine, but we were waiting there. And I said to her, I said, well, if they come in with a nurse, then it's going to be wrong. And it's funny, me as a doctor thinking, let's go in with a nurse because they're really good. And the nurses are tremendous, and you do need the team support and all the nurses. But actually me thinking funny little things, if they came in with a nurse, it must be bad news. And she didn't come in with a nurse, which was good. I suppose I'm not experiencing it, but I'm probably seeing people like you coming for scans, coming every 3 months, and it must be awfully difficult still.
Yeah. I mean, this is a bit of a digression, but I mean, what Sarah was saying reminded me of something that the medical team, the nurses, the doctors, the oncologists, and become part of your kind of wider, almost like a friendship group.
Yes.
And I remember I had a period of 2 years. Diagnosed in 2014, but the end of 2015 had an all clear. And then I had a period of nearly 2 years of all clears, and I just stopped going to the clinics. I suddenly realised I was getting withdrawal symptoms that I actually missed. And then when I did go back to clinic, when the wretched thing came back in end of 2017 and 2018, it was like a reunion. You know, we were all sort of thinking, "Oh, hello again," and it was like, "Oh God, but life's back to normal."
Yeah.
With your friends, Sarah, now being a younger person, how did they deal with it? Were they able to give you support, or was it just so much of a shock, so kind of left field that they couldn't cope?
No, the support I got was amazing. I don't think many of them knew anybody else our age who'd got cancer. I had some lovely friends around me, and also people that I didn't even know that well were just sort of arriving with plates of food, and our church community was put us on a meal train, and we had food being delivered, and people just dropping off books and saying, can we take the children for you? And friends just saying, look, can I come and sit under a blanket and chat and have a cup of tea? So it was amazing. The support I received was incredible.
By the way, were you a working mum?
No, so I'd been on maternity leave, so and I wasn't planning to go back to the teaching job that I was doing. And I still haven't gone back. So
have you not?
Yes. So Theo is due to start school in September, so that's when I think I will need to think about what I'm doing a little bit.
Mark, just to go back on the question of treatment, you said earlier that actually if an elderly person is fit, then they can have the same sort of treatment. Are there any other differences in when you're looking at a patient, a younger patient, that you've got to be aware of as a oncologist?
I think it's the drugs, certainly that you had, the oxaliplatin, the one that makes your fingers tingle, and the capecitabine tablets are the same, really. We would often use those. Nowadays, I think they're... is a definite advance, because you may have had 6 months of treatment, did you?
Or? Yes, although I think initially I was due to have 8 cycles, and then I think there was some research that was done.
Yeah, well, that's
treatment.
It. The research has come out to say you only need 4 now, so you need 3 months of treatment, which is great, because actually...
You
only need 3 months of chemotherapy now after a bowel cancer has been removed, compared to 6.
But
the vast majority of people, not everybody, but the vast majority. And so that's a huge advance, because actually people can probably just cope, me seeing them cope with the first 3 months. The second 3 months is really hard. Yeah. And so it's really nice that actually you can get everything you want in those first 3 months. The treatment, as I say, is there. It's very similar. There's only certain drugs you can use. But again, as I did mention earlier, it's the effect on work. They can't work. Then have they got a job that's supportive, that will actually keep their job? Will they be paying them? And then if things, I suppose, in younger people, for example, you might have booked a holiday to, you mentioned Sri Lanka, if you're going to Sri Lanka, and then suddenly you can't go because you're having chemotherapy. Then if you want to go at the end of it all, you then got to find insurance.
Yeah.
And insurance is sometimes very difficult. And then you also have to think of the medical care sometimes in countries as well. So there's so many little things that I'm not saying aren't there for people who are older than 50, but certainly they may be more of an issue in younger people compared to the older group.
I mean, this goes back to the thing that, you know, doctors need to treat the person in front of them rather than the disease.
Yeah.
You've got to make all these calculations.
Everybody's an individual.
Everybody's different. And, you know, if you saw Sarah, you've got to think of all the responsibilities and so on. But I mean, presumably there comes, you know, there is a point where you can't really make any, you know, titrate too much, you know, and think, oh dear, Sarah's got three kids and a newborn. I'll soften up. I mean, presumably in the end, you've just got to go with the disease.
I think that's it, certainly. But you're right. When it usually very quickly in the first 10, 15 minutes, I'm thinking, well, how old are they? What job have they got? What's the finances going to be like? I'm not saying it. I'm just thinking this or there. Do they, for example, play the piano? Can they have oxaliplatin? Have they got any other illnesses, any other tablets that might interact? So within a very short period, a doctor will be actually thinking, right, I've got all that now, and let's think of the best treatment for them. But it does come down that, well, those are the best drugs. You've got to recommend the best treatment. And I think we're here to advise and guide. We can't force people to have it, because some people would decide, look, I don't want the injection. I don't really fancy that. I just want the tablet treatment.
Right.
And that's reasonable as well. But I think to say somebody's right and somebody's wrong isn't correct. I think you've got to support people as individuals, whether they have the injections or the tablets or the tablets. You try and be helpful to everybody, I think, there. And that's when the team approach comes in it, with the nurse specialist that no doubt you saw. Yes. And in my clinics, for example, I'm there with, for example, on a Monday, we have three other consultants, we have three research nurses, a couple of nurse specialists, we have nurse clinicians, we have chemotherapy nurses. I know we're a big centre at the Christian, we may be very fortunate we have all of that, but actually it's a very much a team approach. And so sometimes when we have a lot of patients coming to clinics, I can't see everybody. I often give advice on a lot of them, even though I don't go into the room.
Right.
But people, it's nice to have a group, because sometimes patients get really attached to one of the nurses, and actually they much prefer the nurses seeing them than me. They don't want me there, they want the nurses.
I've said this before. I mean, if you're a patient, actually, you obviously see the nurses much more often, and they kind of know you more.
That's it.
They can look you in the eye and they can say, what's wrong with you today? How are you not feeling very well, are you? Yeah. I mean, I've literally had nurses say that when I go, even when it's just going for my, you know, every 2 week infusion.
Yeah.
A couple of times a nurse saying, you don't look as well as you normally do, kind of thing. What's up?
Well, we always try and, I suppose, remember like hobbies and things. I suppose I'm pretty good at remembering what football team they all support. I've been Manchester United being the Vets football team.
Yeah.
We always think of football as a very, and I think probably it breaks down the barriers. I would say on a Monday morning after the weekend football, we might be talking about football for a few minutes, but actually that relaxes people.
Yes.
And then you can really get into the problems there, really, with it all.
I just want to come back to Dan. How old is he, by the way?
So he is now 43.
Right, so you're...
he's just a year older.
A year older. So he went for counselling. Did you go to counselling together or separately?
No, he went on his own. And he went pretty
And did
much...
you decide that?
Yes.
That you should do it? Why was that?
So I think he just felt that after the treatment had finished and we were trying to get life back to normal, that it would just be good to try and process it all. But he went quite soon after I'd finished treatment, whereas I had my counselling kind of 18 months, 2 years after I finished my treatment.
Right. And as you and Dan obviously talked about this, I mean, what were his fears? I mean, so early in your
yes.
life together, yeah. with your children so young, what kind of fears was...
I think he was just fearful of you know, again, the children not having their mum, him not having his wife, and just how different life could look, you know, and we'd come through it. But I think also then having that anxiety and that sense that things can change really quickly in the blink of an eye. And we never saw this coming. I don't think anybody ever sees this coming.
No.
But you know, we'd got so many plans and things that we were doing, and this was almost a massive inconvenience. And I think, I guess it's the fragility of life, isn't it? That it's suddenly it's there and you just think, gosh, it rocks you. It really rocks you. But I think he really benefited, as did I, from speaking about it and just having that time to kind of delve deeper into your feelings about it.
Did you consider going to counselling together?
No. I think it was much more he'd have his space and I'd have mine. You know?
Right. And you mentioned earlier that you've got faith. You're Christian, aren't
yes.
you? And has that been an important part of how you've dealt with this?
Yeah, because I'm not afraid of dying. You know, I don't want to die. I absolutely want to be here, but I am not afraid of dying. And I think that takes the fear factor away. It really does for me. But then I'd also be thinking, well, it's all right if I die. I'm quite happy. You know, I know that I'm going to a better place. But then it was the thought of leaving Dan and my children without me that was so heartbreaking. But we had this amazing community around us, you know, people from church who you know, were so generous and supportive. That really helped us get through.
Mark, we're running out of time, but just to sum all this up, your advice, you know, certainly would be that don't think that because you're 39 or 35, your symptoms are not going to be cancer. I mean, you don't want to be alarmist, but on the other hand, you can't rule yourself out.
Exactly. I think at the age of 39, with some of those symptoms that we described earlier, you probably haven't got cancer. But saying that, you could do, and you shouldn't ignore them. And if you have got, especially bleeding, a change in bowel habit, you must go to your GP, explain the symptoms very clearly, think about your family history, because that is very useful as well. And if, for example, that doesn't work the first time by going to a GP, then obviously go back again. And I'm not saying that you've got a plan to keep going back. Hopefully, it's like Sarah, it'll happen on the first time. Mm. But saying that, if you do have to go back again, and sometimes, same with everybody, every doctor, everybody around, every nurse, you might find there's one you click with and one you don't. And so if you see one GP, and you'd actually prefer to see this other one, this other lady you've seen before who was great, then go and see that one as well. So don't ignore your symptoms. You must remember that.
I don't want to put you in an invidious position, but any advice to GPs? Because, I mean, the research that we're sort of seeing from the Never Too Young report from Bowel Cancer UK suggests that, you know, there is an issue there between, you know, in the GP surgery.
Yeah. I would say to them that they're probably right in thinking that bowel cancer in that age group is rare, but they're completely wrong in thinking, and I hope they don't think this, but it doesn't happen in the under 50s. It definitely can happen in the under 50s, but it rarely does. And so if people come in under the age of 50, but 60, 70, whatever age, if they've got bleeding, change in bowel habit or other symptoms of the gut, then they must be taken seriously and referred on to a team that specialise in that to carry out a colonoscopy, to look inside or to carry out scans, whatever is appropriate. So, yeah, they should think it can happen under 50.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. And, we've run out of time. There's always more to talk about, but I do think we've kind of explored this issue of young people and bowel cancer, and the fact that it's happening more often. And we've, you know, explored why a younger person may be diagnosed with a disease and where to go if you've been affected by the disease. So thank you so much, Sarah, for talking so honestly, and I know I could sense there were times in the last half an hour or so when it was quite difficult. Yeah. It brings up kind of emotions, weren't they? So thank you for that and for sharing it. And I know our listeners are going to appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark, as ever, thank you again for bringing your expert advice and knowledge to this podcast. Thank you
thank
very
you
much.
For That's
not at all. Mark Saunders there from the Christie in Manchester. Now to find out more about younger people with bowel cancer, all you've got to do is download or order for free Bowel Cancer UK's Younger People with Bowel Cancer Guide. Visit their website, that's bowelcanceruk.org.uk. So thank you so much, all of you, for listening to this podcast. Don't forget to carry on the conversation on social media. Tag us on @BowelCancerUK. From me, George Alagaya, from Mark and from Sarah, thank you for listening.